Hello.
Hello? Hey,
Andrea?
this is Andrea. Yep, that's me.
Hi, it's Joanne.
Hi.
How are
How are you
you?
doing? I'm good. I've been I had a really good phone call this morning with a curator, and I've been pretty good. I don't know. I feel good. How are you?
Good. I'm well, thank you. Well, that's good news. You got a good conversation with a curator. I assume there are possibilities there for you.
No, it's pretty exciting. But I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about it yet, so I should probably not even
No,
bring
I
it up. But
understand.
yeah.
I totally understand. Well, it couldn't be happening at a better time for you, right?
It's I don't know, I've been making artwork out of my apartment, and it's been, I don't know, it's been a kind of a challenging experiment. I've been so spoiled to have a studio for so long that I don't like working from home, I've decided.
So are you having to use different materials?
No, but and I have this really interesting, elaborate way of letting my work dry, so the cats aren't able to walk across it. It's been a daily struggle to keep it of my artwork. And I probably hair painted into my art at the moment. So I don't like working at home is the short of it.
How soon, I guess you don't know how soon you'll be able to get back to your studio.
I have visited it a couple of times, but I think they're maybe in my studio building, the Flatiron in Chicago. I think that there's some people who live in these studios, and so I don't want to, I don't want to really risk it quite yet. But I have been in a couple of times just to move stuff around, and but it's there's shared bathrooms, and there's
I
it's a little
understand.
bit riskier, than
Sure.
being at home.
So what do you find exciting or interesting that's emerging from your stay-at-home studio?
Well, I really, really don't enjoy it at all, because the last piece I worked on was called Red Exit, and it's a really large scale piece, and so I couldn't actually see the entire piece because my apartment isn't large enough to lay it all out. It's in 60 different segments or different sheets of paper, so I could put down half of it, and I could take a photograph of it, then put down the other half of it, take a photograph of that, and then put them on my computer and like put them side by side or crop them into each other to kind of see what the overall look of the work looks like. But I just hung it a couple of weeks ago for the first time in a Berkeley gallery, so I was able to see the piece all together for the first time, and I was really happy with how it turned out, considering I made a lot of decisions without kind of full knowledge of what I was doing. So
So it required
I've
something really different from you, didn't
it did, but it was good to know that I can think abstractly enough, or I can like maintain an overall vision in my head, that even when I see parts, it's still, I can still kind of make it work out. So I was very proud. But yeah, there's not much about working at home that I enjoy, but I do like that post coronavirus and post lockdown, a lot of the restaurants that deliver, you can get like a gallon of margarita. So I just absolutely think that needs to continue. The delivered alcohol needs to go on in perpetuity. I'm never going to go back to not having delivered margarita.
I love it. How long have you been in Chicago, Andrea?
About 4 years. So actually I moved in 2016, like right after the election. So it's been nearly 4 years for me. And then before that I was in Minneapolis for my whole adult life, and in Minnesota for my whole life. So, Chicago was the first time I had moved out of Minnesota, and that was, only about 4 years ago.
What took you to Chicago?
Well, I still haven't applied, but I would like to go to grad school, and I'd like to go to Northwestern or UIC. My husband got a really excellent job offer in Chicago, and we were both kind of feeling that wanderlust. You know, we just kind of, even though it's still the Midwest, we kind of wanted, you know, just to kind of, you know, we got into such a routine in Minneapolis that I think we just kind of wanted a new challenge or a new environment. And I was on so many boards and so entrenched in the Minneapolis community that moving to Chicago was like a little bit of breathing room where I could just, you know, quit all the boards and not know anybody and really, you know, kind of start all over, even though I really miss Minneapolis, but I love Chicago. I'm like definitely warming up to, you know, a bigger city.
Have you been able to connect to the art scene in Chicago?
Not really. Like some artists, I definitely have connected to the artists that are native in Chicago. We kind of have a little kind of indigenous futurist kind of art club or art crew. We're always, you know, on the same panels and in the same space. And so I do have my kind of intimate group of friends here in Chicago. But it's not in the same way as it was in Minneapolis, where I knew everybody. And, you know, I was on all of the art panels, and I had to, it was kind of a bit of a gatekeeper, like had to juror for a lot of, you know, various grants and was on the selection committee for the Minneapolis Institute of Arts and on the board at the Hoo Visual Arts Center. And, you know, just really, was just kind of doing a lot of kind of free labor for the arts community. And so I haven't really stepped into that role in Chicago yet, but I can see that a lot of people are kind of itching to put me on boards. And I agreed to be on the Illinois State Museum board, but we've only had one meeting, so I can't complain about that. But yeah, it's there's a lot of opportunity for free labor in the arts world.
And there's plenty of that in Chicago, plenty of opportunities.
Yeah.
Well, I have some connections in Chicago. I'd be happy to introduce you if when you would like that to happen.
Like post-vaccine?
Yes.
It seems like all the new people that I've met like during this time, you know, I'll have Zoom meetings and stuff, but it's not the same. It doesn't have the same, you know, as like going to coffee with someone and, you know, it doesn't feel like, it feels like there's a moderator, or there's, you know, it's just not the same as in person.
It feels stilted. It's hard to carry on a conversation. You know, there are these pauses and these breaks, and it just doesn't work for me either. Let's reminisce a little bit and go back to Minnesota and Minneapolis and your youth. I believe your parents were both artistic.
Yes.
If I remember reading that correctly. So I'm interested in when you began to identify yourself as an artist.
Well, I think, I don't know that I had like a choice. I can't remember not identifying as an artist because I just feel like as soon as I could even, as I have any memories, I was always like making things and always, you know, taking things apart and putting things back together. And my this little stuff from here that I made out of pantyhose and tissue paper and kept it, and he still has it. And he swears I was 3 years old when I made it. and he's kept it around, and it was just kind of one of those things where it's like, I want to make something look like something else. I want to take what's in front of me and, you know, just kind of transform it into something that I have in my head. And, but he was always encouraging that. And I remember in kindergarten, him, you know, sitting down and showing me how to draw a face and like, you know, what the ratios were and how to, you know, where to put the eyes and like, you know, to you know, properly draw a face and, with all the rules. And, so I feel like he kind of, you know, definitely pushed that early on. And a lot of my artist friends will talk about how their parents wanted them to pursue something that might have been more lucrative for them and maybe not supported their art careers as much, but I feel like this other real small child, I was, you know, kind of funneled in that direction and encouraged, and that was really celebrated in my family. Just any creativity and any way of seeing things slightly different was more championed than maybe common interpretations of things or just a common view of things. I think that was, you know, definitely something celebrated in my family.
When you look back at the piece that your father has and saved, I imagine there were many others, can you identify elements in it that have persisted?
Well, I think I see a lot of like my childhood art, and I feel like there's some like, oh, at that stage in my life, this is how I would, you know, kind of deconstruct that type of a maybe an animal or that kind of, you know, I really was into deers and horses and anything that had long legs and, you know, a long nose. That was my animal of choice was horses and deer. So there's a lot of drawings where I really was drawn towards that. But that might just be, you know, gendered aesthetic, liking horses as a child. But there are some things where I can, you know, look back over just the length of my career and see, like, this is what I made. And then I learned from that thing that I made and I wanted to push it in this direction. Or this piece taught me something that I hadn't come across before. And then that'll be the seed for the next project or the next piece. So I figured that out and I kind of want to push it slightly. And I haven't yet come to that point where I've like plateaued, where I've become bored. I've always have another something on the back burner that I want to try out. I want to see what it looks like. So I kind of, you know, most of the projects that I start, I have a vision in the back of my head of just kind of maybe a foggy view of what it might look like and what it, you know, how the, maybe the color palette or something formal about an image that I want to see what it looks like and pull it to the surface. And then while I'm working on it or while I'm, you know, kind of amassing some of the imagery, I start pursuing the meaning of what these things are and why these elements are surfacing up in the work. It's kind of, it's not a determinist. It's kind of like a conversation back and forth between, you know, this very kind of visual formal world and this more intellectual decision-making process. So I kind of have this internal back and forth conversation. Like I just finished this Red Excess piece and it was reviewed in Hyperallergic, and my reviewer, Sheila Regan, had pointed out that one of the figures has this, you know, kind of animate shadow in it. And I really liked how she described that because I haven't really played around with a lot of shadows for the objects or elements in my work. And so it planted a little seed in the back of my mind, and now I'm already starting to like cook up a bunch of ideas that play with this kind of shadow silhouetting, you know, between the objects or figures in my work and the landscape that they rest upon. So that's going to be the next thing that, you know, that I think I might pursue. But it is, it's like, you know, you finish a thing and, or while you're working on that thing, there's an idea that you have that you can't put in the current work. And so you kind of flag it. And then, you know, when you finish, then you have that waiting for you. You have the next idea waiting. So it doesn't always work that way, but it's nice when it does.
It's like a tease, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Keeps you moving forward. Do you keep a journal, or do you document ideas and thoughts in any regular way?
I have a sketchbook that is way too, I think, like almost overdeveloped sketches. And sometimes I'll allow myself to put little notes in the margin. Mm-hmm. But I have these really messy, just three-ring like lined paper binders, and that's where the good stuff ends up, is in the lines, not even like drawing paper, where it's just these like really fast scale sketches with, you know, notes all over them. That's where all my good ideas are. And then my formal, you know, drawing sketchbook is, you know, it's trying to be art, I think. It's trying to impress too much. So when I start a new piece, I go back to the notes and the lined paper book, because that's where all the gems are. But
do you save all of those?
I do and I don't, because there's some of it is like just lists of like to-dos, like chores, like go look this thing up and go chase down this information and, you know, respond to this email. So that stuff is, I typically just rip that out and throw it away. But some of them I keep around. What I really need to do is, get a box or get some kind of organization system down and actually like kind of sequence these things, like when they were made and what they're referring to. I think it would be, I should probably do some kind of archival type stuff, because, you know, because I don't take it that seriously, because it's just ephemera. But I know that there's some people that are interested in all the ephemera around art making, so I should probably take it more seriously.
Well, for me as a collector, it's sort of, I mean, I'm interested. I do collect journals or sketchbooks or however you refer to them, but I'm interested in the stream of consciousness. Let's make it into your head, and brings me closer to the work and understanding how you think and processes. Mm-hmm. And also I find when artists visit and I pull out their journals, if I have them, and we go back and look through them, inevitably they're going to stumble on something they've forgotten about that happens to be present in their work at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's ever evolving, and so I think they're important for that alone.
Yeah, I was looking through some old paperwork actually maybe a couple months ago, and I found this little quick sketches for, had an idea for a series of paintings, and I'm glad I didn't pursue them, because I know that I would have spent a lot of time on them, and like now I probably wouldn't enjoy the content as much. But I love the little reminder of like, oh, I'm so glad I didn't pursue that, but it's so interesting, like I would have totally forgotten about this, you know, idea for a series had I not written it down and kept it. So but yeah, there's a lot of I should probably definitely get the, I don't, there's so many artists that really like kind of don't want to talk about process, like what gets them to some of the decisions that they've made. And I feel like the older I get, the more I love listening to artists talk about their process and how they've come to some of the decisions that they've made. And I've totally gone like 180 degrees from where it was a few years ago. And but there's still a lot of artists that, you know, that talking about process kind of, you know, they don't like it. And I feel like that's where the magic is. That's where the, you know, like I get this a lot with talking to writers and poets, where they talk about where, like if they're a novelist, like how they develop a character that has a distinct personality from all of the other characters, and how they relate and talk to each other, and how you keep that straight in your head. And Leanne Howe, who is a Choctaw novelist and poet, was telling me that she has students, she's a teacher too, she's saying that she, you know, has this project where she has the students take a piece of music, like a jazz song that has very distinct instruments that you can hear. And she's like, write a character for each one of those instruments and how they interplay with each other and how they're very separate voices from one another. But taking like something abstract as like, say, jazz music, and then making characters off of the various instruments and their parts is, I think, I'm not a novelist, but learning that that is a potential process or a way that a person could develop characters is really inspiring to me, even though I have nothing, I have no place to take that.
Not yet.
Yeah, not yet, but I just, like, that's just, it's so cool. It's such a cool way, it's such a cool creative process that that I don't know. I guess I don't do as many kind of tasks like that to get there, but I do, you know, like I'll sometimes take a projector and project some text onto a surface and see how that light changes, you know, that sculpture changes that drawing, or I'll print out a bunch of my drawings and I'll cut them up and then reassemble them to see if there's, you know, to see if there's a different way of organizing those lines or the features in them, in like the face of a monster. You know, I'll do these things that, you know, aren't very precious, but, you know, that can teach me something or give me a different way of looking at it. So I can understand how writers also do that. So, just the older I'm getting, the more fascinated I am by thought processes and just how people get to the decisions, how people get to the art rather than the final production. So
it's a keen interest of mine. I call my studio visits archaeological digs.
Yeah.
Because I go to the studio because I know the work of the moment, mm-hmm. but I really want to know where it comes from. Mm-hmm. And I'm digging around for the integrity of the artist, in essence. I'm looking for these threads that have been there from the beginning and continue to weave through the work and become an essential in the artistry. That means a lot to me. And it gives me greater confidence about the person and the work.
Mm-hmm.
You are a collector of things.
I am a little bit. I don't know. I have a little tiny art collection, but that's mostly born off of relationships with artists and art trades, and, you know, how artists are always giving each other, you know, freebies and artist exchange type stuff. I'm not a minimalist, but I don't have a lot of stuff. I have a lot of stuff in my studio, but I'm kind of very particular with the things that I, you know, that I bring in. I have a really cool art collection that is mostly, you know, through kind of like intimate relationships with other artists and people that I really want to keep around me. Like, you know, I see these Jim Denemy paintings every day and I absolutely love and cherish him. And so when I see them, I just, you know, it just kind of grounds me and makes me feel like I'm surrounded by all the loved ones, even though they're paintings or drawings. I feel like, you know, it's kind of environment making for myself. And I find surrounding myself with other artists' artwork as an artist, that it kind of affects how you think and how you organize information on a page. If you have, you know, if you see the same painting every day, it's almost like you start getting drawn to something that's similar. So I try not to harvest from the other artists their ideas, but I do think that it affects how you see things a little bit.
Don't you think it prompts you to connect with something deeper within yourself?
Yeah, maybe. I probably have totally different takes on what they were, what they were trying to express and achieve.
And that's okay.
Yeah, but you know, I definitely, I was raised in Grand Portage, Ojibwe, and the famous artist from Grand Portage he's deceased, is George Morrison. And he does these beautiful, abstract, bright, colorful paintings, which mostly have this like very strong horizontal line in all of them. And it's because it's the lake, it's Lake Superior that he grew up on, and that every, you know, artist that lives on a big lake, like now I'm on Lake Michigan, but I grew up on Rainy Lake and in Grand Marais, Minnesota on Lake Superior. So once you kind of get that landscape or that seascape, I guess, baked into your mind, this infinity line where you can't see the other side of the lake, it's almost like that's how you organize information, like everything's on the beach. So, but I grew up knowing George, and, you know, I was a little kid. He died in 2001. Anyway, but when I was like 15 years old, my dad was bragging off my work to George, and he was like, you know, you're doing everything right. You're starting off young. Now paint until you die. Like, he kind of gave me that, you know, paint until you die. And you know, I have every intention on painting until I die, but I think that being kind of surrounded by George Morrison's artwork growing up, going to all of his exhibitions and having catalogs of his work in my house, you know, growing up as a child, like, I, even though my work doesn't look anything like George Morrison's work, that strong line, that horizontal line of like this endless seascape is in nearly every one of my paintings. I can't work the lake out of my art. And I think that was probably due to the influence of George, and how he organized, you know, all these figures or abstract figures on this kind of infinity lake landscape. He also said, like, have you ever looked at the very, you know, either dusk or dawn, or when the weather is kind of turbulent or before turbulent weather, you look out over the lake and kind of squint your eyes, even on the bluest of day, it almost seems like there's this really thin red line that runs along that horizon line. And sometimes I imagine it in, but for a while I was painting this really, really thin little bead of magenta or red along the, where the water meets the sky, as kind of like a, just because of this really young memory of him telling me and my dad that about the lake. So there are things where it's like, if you hear it young enough, it definitely gets grafted onto your mind, and then, you know, it's how you start organizing information, and it becomes your template. And I think in the piece you have, there's a really, you know, really strong kind of horizontal line behind all the figuration too.
But you've made it your own now.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't look like George.
Which is wonderful, you know. And you mentioned jazz, and it's like the same with the oral history in jazz. Mm-hmm. The mentor passes it on to the student, and then mm-hmm. it lives on, but through a new voice. So it's a beautiful thing. And I really appreciate your relationship to water and that horizon line. It's, it kind of feeds your soul, I think.
Mm-hmm. People in the desert also get that. Like, people who are, like, out and more, you know, further out in Santa Fe, will be talking about, like, this endless seascape, and people in, like, New Mexico and in Arizona that have seen, like, you know, very flat desert will be like, oh, no, I get that, too. It's also, like, it's also a really, really pleasant landscape that gets kind of, you know, they also have, like, these kind of mesas and stuff, but you know what I mean? Like, how they get the landscape baked into their minds the same way I have the lake baked into mine.
Well, it was all underwater at one time, so you can use your imagination a little, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Talk to me about drawing specifically for you.
So I used to call call everything a drawing. And I think it might come, you know, the very graphic nature of my work, and I work a lot on paper. And when you use ink on paper, oftentimes people will call that a drawing, even though it's kind of painted with brushes. And I read a lot of comic books, and I definitely like to look in at the different line quality and how the ink was laid down on a page and to tell a story. I make some things my own, but there's kind of when it comes to painting and drawing for me, I feel like they're very, you know, there's a strong connection. It's, you know, you either have a felt tip pen, or you have bristles, or you have, you know, graphite, but it's, you know, you're kind of laying down of materials onto, you know, a very thirsty, I think a very thirsty surface, which is paper. I do not like painting on canvas or drawing on canvas, or, you know, I did these prints with High Point Center for Printmaking that was painting with acrylic on Mylar, like a plastic film, and I hated that because paper is so, it's like a skin, but it, you know, when you take like a marker, if you take like an inked brush, or it drinks in the color and just such a, it's a really amazing surface to work on. So what I typically do is, I like putting down various washes of ink or watercolor, and then I like taking these jelly roll pens or graphite or Prismacolor pencils and kind of working over the surface. So it's like underpainted and then drawn on top of it. And that's for the more colorful work that I do. I think the black and white work, you know, I have to let more of the paper, you know, be raw and kind of come up and be visible from under the drawing. But I don't know. For me, I see drawing as, I feel like my painting is actually drawn. And there's a curator that I was working with years ago, and she was not willing to call my work painting. And I kind of liked that because it was like she knew more of like the process behind how I make my art. I think she's like, yeah, those materials are typically drawing materials. You're working on paper. But it doesn't look like maybe a sketch. It looks, it's like your the trade-off between painting and drawing is just, you know, it's almost made up, or I jump across that magical line a bunch, in my work. So for me with drawing, it is the structure. It is where I start. It is the bones of anything that I make. It has to start with drawing. And then I build up. I put all the skin on those bones. But I think the piece you have doesn't have as much of the build up of, because I think there's enough ink on it that I have a lot of paper poking out, and then there's some oil for that to try to push the horizon line back. You know, the soft gradation of the oil paint on these painted surfaces kind of push back that horizon. If it was entirely flat, when it's entirely flat, then I have to use like wave patterns or cloud patterns to try to push back that horizon line as far as I can get it. So,
you know, sometimes an artist who draws through the lens of the sculptor,
mm-hmm.
Or draws through the lens of the painter,
mm-hmm.
or the reverse. And so I think it's really left up to the interpretation of the artist and the observer. You might
yeah.
see it as a painting, and I'll read it as a drawing. So after all my time looking at drawings these last 15 years, if it feels like a drawing, it is a drawing for me.
I was talking to the sculptor.
Yeah.
Well, I was talking to a sculptor about like the additive and subtractive ways of sculpting. Like if you're working in clay, you can both carve out a chunk of clay, but you can also add clay onto an area. So it's both like additive and subtractive as far as material. But if you're working with a block of wood, you're mostly subtractive. You know, you can add another bit of wood onto an area, but if you're working in stone and wood and you don't want to do that, you're just pulling out the parts that, you know, it's subtractive. I feel like with drawing, it's also kind of like clay. It's both additive and subtractive. You
mm-hmm.
can, you do kind of carve. You can put in areas and you can erase areas and you can, you know, draw over areas, or, you know, there's something very sculptural about drawing, I feel. And it's so forgiving, like drawing just as, you know, it's so rudimentary. It's the sculptor and painter, every artist kind of absolutely has to have drawing. I feel like that's just, is the bones of artwork, really. And even, I would say, photographers really should draw. I feel like it's something that is getting worked out of a lot of the curriculums right now, where it's not seen as necessary for designers or photographers, and that's terrible. I think that drawing is, you know, is kind of one of those, you know, like learning how to spell. Like, it's the basic thing for becoming a writer. Like, you kind of have to have, I feel like you know, just kind of pulling a pencil across a piece of paper is just as rudimentary as you can get. And it's, I don't know, that's probably why I'm a bit romantic about calling my very painted surfaces drawings, you know, even though it has both elements.
I think if it's on paper, it's a drawing. That's the word I use.
Totally.
Because if it's going to be in a museum, they're going to put it in the prints and drawings department. It's not going in the painting department.
Yeah.
So that's been
definitely.
Mine.
Yeah. I agree.
I think that I'm interested in what you just said. I think that for me, I'm very interested in drawing as being central to a studio practice, whether you're a painter, mm-hmm. a sculptor, a performance artist, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Because I really do believe if you are to reach the greater potential of your artistry, you have to put pen to paper, and pencil to paper, whatever, in some fashion. Because I think that releases the creative ideas. Mm-hmm. I think it frees the mind. So for me, if I don't find that in a practice, I'm probably less interested in the work.
Yeah, I totally agree. I see that 100%. And I like, and it is one of those things where you, like, I don't know, like, I'll do these very overworked drawings where I don't want anyone to see my secrets, you know, like, I want it to be nice and tight. But I do think that, you know, in the sketchbooks or in my line journal pages where I scribble it out, I feel like that is, you know, as far as a process, I'm definitely, personally, I'm much more drawn to that. But then when I make my kind of more formal, finalized art, I want to reveal very, very little of my, you know, of my process. The new piece I have has some of these pencil lines poking out, and I was going to erase them. And then what I did was I reinforced them. I just kind of, you know, took a mechanical pencil and I drew them out even stronger. And that was, I had to fight that. And it's like, that's what you want to see in other people's art. Why can't you let that exist in your own?
Because that speaks to a freedom, and that speaks to it not so perfect, right? I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the honesty in the work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Would you spend a little time talking about content?
So,
because your work has layers of history and imagination and mm-hmm. places.
So I'm trying to remember because I did three really small, like 6 to 8 paintings in each one, and then I just put them all together, and you have one of those. So it's either Lust for Gold, Forked Tongues, or Vaster Ink Empire. And I can't remember which one you have. No, you have.
I have First Generation.
Oh, you have First Generation. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the one I, you got the really good one. That one.
Would you say that again, please?
That you got the really, really good one. Because that one has, I feel like I haven't really done colorful pieces that size. You might actually have a one of a kind when it comes to, you know, playing. First of all, I painted that piece on Oberholster's Island in Rainy Lake, Minnesota, all the way up on the Canadian border. Like, from the island, you can see these buoys that separate Canada from the U.S. And I painted that, you know, on an island, which you know, what privileged career I have that I can take off and live on an island to work on my art. So that piece is also really cool because I used, there's some orange in it that is actually, which is, you know, you sometimes see bloodroot on forest floors growing all over. And if you dig up this, you know, it's a little plant, the roots look white when you dig them up and rinse them off. But if you grind up the roots, they bleed red. Mm-hmm. And so I used bloodroot to get some of the orange effect in it, and I hope it's archival. I put some salt in it because I read online that can help preserve it. but the orange, some of the orange in that piece is actually, because I had this idea of at some point putting more and more natural pigments into my artwork. So, but that's been, bloodroot has been used for years to make pigments and like wool blankets and things in the Southwest. So, so your piece is also cool for that. That I wanted to, this kind of, kind of like redigest elements from other pieces. So if you look at my large piece that's in the Minneapolis Institute of Arts collection called Sunshine on a Cannibal, there are like turtle shells and elements of that piece that have been made abstract and kind of cannibalized, I guess, to be in first generation. I was also with the title of it thinking about terms of kinship. So I'm Turtle Clan. And which is, you know, clans are related to kinship. And I was thinking about how this smaller painting on paper is like the kin or relative of Sunshine on a Cannibal, how it is this child, this larger piece's child. But and politically what's happening right now in Native Nations is that we're seeing with blood quantum and with other things, people, like kids not being able to get enrolled. And so they're like the first generation of a child that doesn't have 25% blood quantum will often be called the first generation direct descendant. And then their kids will be second generation direct descendant, but they're not enrolled. So what I was kind of doing with the name was referencing how one could come from the other, but then not be totally included. And I actually think disenrollment and all that is really, it's a terrible, terrible thing. It's not going to set us up right into the future. But I was thinking about these terms like first generation direct descendant, second generation direct descendant as being our new kinship terms. And how it's not something I agree with, but how colonization works with how things are related and how people are related to each other. So I was trying to take that kinship model, the colonial kinship model, and kind of describe a piece as being an offshoot of another piece as far as ideas go, but how that relates to kin. And so it's super abstract.
Well, and that's why I was so taken by it. And, you know, I think I told you that I hadn't seen your work until I saw the big piece, the mm-hmm. cannibal piece at MIA. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
I was with Bob Cozzolino at the time, and I was just mad for that piece. I mean, it just took my breath away. I wanted to just kind of bathe in it. And so I had this idea that I have to find this art. I have to bring this artist into the collection. And then Bob introduced me to Todd. And, you know, typically I have to look at a lot of work, but I was bound to determine to find something that gave me the same feeling.
Yeah. You have a really good piece. That's super funny because Bob is such a paintings guy. Was he like, you know, this is a painting? And you're like, I see it as a drawing.
Right. No. He knows that I only do. Yeah, no, he definitely caught on. And so when I finally, Todd showed me this piece, I was just like, oh, my God, that's it. But because it gave me the same feeling, it's really interesting mm-hmm. when you're telling me about the relationship because
yeah.
I needed to have something that fed me the same way. And it is so abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it has so much narrative in it, but it's so abstract and it makes it perfect for my needs.
Yeah.
It spoke to me so powerfully. I feel very fortunate, actually, to and now even more so with what you tell me about it.
Well, the other thing about it, like, as far as, like, abstraction is when I'm working on my work, like, I know that I'm actually working on, like, say, a turtle shell, or I know that I'm actually working on, like, a mask or a face or a monster or something. I'll know that intellectually, but when I'm working on it, it's lines. It's those, you know, it's these, mm-hmm. those shapes within shapes that I find very interesting. It's that positive and negative space that I just love playing on that, you know, where one meets the other. So I feel like I'm probably an abstract artist, or that's what I'm drawn to, but I also want to throw in so many references and narratives that I, you know, that I'm trying to have it both ways. I'm playing with that intersection.
Well, and the narrative is the writer in you.
Yeah, that's probably true too. Yeah, I definitely.
So, I mean, you're an you think as an abstract, let me say this, you draw as an abstractionist, but it comes mm-hmm. from this thinking place, this as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And so there, yep. that's how you infuse the narrative, but you don't want to give me too much information. You want me to be able to explore on my own.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that that's spot on. And I also, when I'm telling people, like, I don't want to write a big, like, codices on my art and make a big list of references. But then at the same time, I'm like, that's a lie. I kind of do. I want a conspiracy theorist to jump into my work and I don't know. So I definitely am drawn to
it. But you want them to find it. You want them to.
Yeah.
Discover it, correct? I think that's what you do. I think you want them to discover it. It's different if you just overtly put it out there.
Yeah, it sounds like writers, like, oh, there's I don't know if, there's this book by, on poetry, or it is a book of poetry by Heide Erdrich, called The Ephemera. It's, you know, her poems are kind of, you know, just like, gorgeous. It's kind of like she's
what
she's
is the name?
Curator. It's called The Curator of the Ephemera.
Mm-hmm.
And it's by Heide Erdrich. Or Erdrich.
Spell the last name.
E-R-D-R-I-C-H.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this book of poetry, like on the cover is part of my piece Ink Babble. And then neither of us knew this when the publisher, because I gave them like 6 or 7 images to choose for the cover of the book. And what they did was they took little like detail shots of these images and they put them in the actual book itself on the, you know, kind of pulpy pages. But it looks really, I think it looks cool, but she has a poem called Wendigo Eye that is about my work or conversation that her and I have had. And then there's, at the end, she has about the art. And she writes like 2 pages on what she sees in my art and how important place is to my art and, you know, kind of how we have a lot in common with our creative processes. Anyway, that book of poetry, I think, would be, and she has a new book that's coming out of poetry called Little Big Bully, and my art is also on the cover of that. And I've only read a couple poems from it, but I'm really excited. It's, I think, in about a month it'll come out.
Well, I'll get those in my library.
Yeah, because her and I. Yeah, I think you would really dig it. I think that she does. She really loves writing about artwork and it through poetry, which is just so cool.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. I wanted to ask you, and I promised you 45 minutes, and I think we could go an hour and a half, but I can't do that. I wanted to ask you something. I read said that you're currently contemplating space,
mm-hmm.
and something about placing your work in space, and you're rethinking mm-hmm. this notion. I need to know more about that.
So in the piece that I just finished, which is called Red Exit, and which is the sister piece or the companion piece for Ink Babble, this other really like 60 panel large scale piece. It looks, if you were to look at them, like Ink Babble looks like a V of images, like, or like, you know, if you're watching a boat go off into the distance, like the wake on a boat. But all of the repetitive images kind of make that generalized shape. So each column in that piece would be like a time dominant column, because the reiteration of imagery is almost like if you took a film strip out of a camera, out of a, you know, celluloid camera. And if you were to do like a panorama shot on film, take the film out and look at it, each cell would have, you know, say if it was an image of a person, would kind of tick down diagonally from cell to cell. And then when you play it all together, it would just look like a panorama, or it would look like the person was moving across the screen. So,
is it all black and white?
Yeah.
I think I've seen an image of it.
Yeah, so each column in that is like, that's time. But
okay.
The iteration between each of those images is time dominant, and each image slightly moves a little bit or slightly changes from cell to cell. So that's like a panorama, but it's time dominant. And then along the horizon, that's space dominant, because it's just a long like panorama shot. If you were to do like still photography or a still image, a panorama would just be a really long landscape. So there's like 10 stacked landscapes with each column time dominant and each row space dominant. And I was thinking about like the intersection between time and space, and on physics, are they kind of the same thing, or they're expressed, you know, slightly differently, but time and space are related. So I was thinking of how would I organize information along this axis of time and space. And so I kind of did it through the idea of like a film strip, how that organizes time, and how, you know, like how panoramas organize space, and then intersected those two through the painting. And so I've been thinking a lot about place and about space. A lot of my War series has that infinity landscape, that horizon line will be consistent from piece to piece. So if I have 10 in a row, the horizon line is at the same height in each of the paintings, mm-hmm. and or drawings, and whatever you want to call them, the horizon line continues from work to work. And that is referencing that we live on one landscape, not many landscapes. We live on a sphere, and topologically a sphere is, you know, one surface. So all landscapes are unified. And so I was thinking, if we have this kind of unified sphere, that all we're seeing in a landscape is just a little bite-sized piece of this giant sphere, this one surface. So I wanted to kind of draw upon that one surface with making sure that the horizon line was consistent from piece to piece, and that if they were hung together, they would also be unified. So that was one of the ideas about space and how space can be handled on a page. But I've been playing around with place and space and time for a while in my work. I probably overthink it a little bit.
Well, I know
but
that
your
I mean,
piece is. I would say that the piece you have is like folded time and space. There's like some really dominant folds in your piece, where like both the horizon lines and the stackedness, because there's some horizon lines, but they're also kind of stacked and like folded into each other. So yours is more of a origami of a landscape, I would say.
Like what your work demands of me as the observer. I think that's one of the things that struck me so when I saw the large piece in Mia, because mm-hmm. I like close observation.
Mm-hmm.
And while I can take it in only in pieces, when you look at the whole thing, mm-hmm. It demands me to get up and really look and observe closely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's powerful.
Yeah, I think that was probably some of the intention when I started off making a large scale work, was I wanted to make imagery that people couldn't dismiss. You know, I go into gallery shows and sometimes I'll just breeze through some galleries and won't spend time with other artists' artwork. And I wanted to not be that artist. I wanted to make something where it held people, couldn't be dismissed so quickly.
You can't get it if you just walk by it.
Yeah, or there's something that like, did I see that right? Did I see that correctly? Mm-hmm. And people mm-hmm. have to go investigate. So
yeah,
I think I was
exactly.
I think I was going for that just because that's what I wanted from artwork. And so I definitely had intended that. But I'm glad that you got it because a lot of people did walk right by it because I watched them in the gallery.
Then they're not really looking. They're not there. They're just for a stroll. What's in your mind now? You already mentioned the one thing to me that you're thinking about. Is there anything else? Maybe something historical or something in terms of process or materiality?
Yeah, all those things. I've been doing some public art lately, which is not really I don't think it's like the where I like painting and drawing. I like kind of being in the materials and on the surface of the paper. I like kind of getting into that. But I've been commissioned for several public artworks, and one of them is along the Chicago River in downtown Chicago off of DuSable Bridge. It's a really important historical place because it used to be the former site of Fort Dearborn, where there was several battles that took place there where settlers had set up and the natives didn't want them there. So it's a very historical place on the river. It's also the site of a Blackhawks merchandise store, and it's Michigan Avenue is right on there. So it's a really important place for like Native resistance. A lot of the protests will meet there just because of the historical significance for Native people. It's also everything between Michigan Avenue and the river is all that landfill. And that's, considered unceded Potawatomi land. So I'm making five giant billboards that the city commissioned me. They're not billboards per se, they're like giant banners that are like 30 feet long each. And so I'm making paintings for the background, but then it'll have the text superimposed on it, you're on Potawatomi land, in both English and Ojibwe Mo in the Potawatomi language. So I'm working with a Potawatomi historian that nation is really closely related to the Ojibwe people. Chicago is Three Fires land. So it's Ojibwe, Odawa, and Potawatomi are the Three Fires. So I'm also curating a show with John Lau, the Potawatomi historian at the MacArthur Foundation. They are in the Marquette building, and the building is really problematic because it has all of these Tiffany murals that are about Marquette and Joliet, the explorers and the Jesuit priests that came through and discovered Chicago, and all of these like terrible settler triumphant type narrative. And so John Lau and I are curating a show on like how problematic the murals are, but also we decided to take it into the direction to really celebrate the Potawatomi people. So all of our like wall tags will be in English and in Potawatomi language. So that's a really fun thing that I'm working on right now that I'm excited to help out in that. And and it's been very, I've definitely, even though I've only been here for 4 years, I've really learned a lot about Chicago, Indigenous people in Chicago, and the history of just the terrible history of how Chicago was settled and taken away. Like, they don't teach about the Trail of Death in school. They might hear about the Trail of Tears, but nobody knows about the Trail of Death.
No.
So that was the part.
Well, these are wonderful projects. I lived in Chicago for 20 years.
Oh, wow. So this is your...
I spent all of my young adult years out of college in Chicago, so it was home to me for a long time, so I can vision where you're talking about. I'm very excited for you, Andrea.
I'm excited, too. I'm
excited about your work and this idea of, I wanted to talk to you more about language because I thought that was interesting, too, your interest in the difference in language between English and some of the Indigenous languages, but we've already talked for an hour.
Okay.
There's more I want to know. So maybe we have to have a part two next quarter. Maybe we'll continue. I'll post this with others in September, and then I won't do the next posting until January. So maybe I'll have to call you back and we'll continue, because I've just got like 10 more questions I wanted to ask you. I would enjoy it too. I'm sorry you've taken up so much of your time, but I'm so very pleased to meet you by phone. I'm pleased to have you in the collection, and I will continue to follow your work, and we'll look for some other magical piece to augment. And I'm looking at Morrison's work too, because I think having a piece of his along with yours would just tell a great story. Look forward to that. But I'd be happy to introduce you to some people in Chicago. I can send you an email and give you some names, and if you're interested, then I'll send an introductory email, because I know some dealers and some curators at the Art Institute. But I think they would be very interested in your work. Okay, good.
All right.
Well, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day. Keep working. I hope you get back in your studio soon enough. It sounds like you're doing just fine, even though you hate it.
Thank you so much.
I'm having to do housework, which I hate, too. So, well, thank you so much. It's been a real privilege. And so what I'm going to do is, you know, this will be posted, the entire audio. I'll extract a few quotes from it. Maybe not directly, but ideas that from it, and I'll send those to you so you can look at those before they're actually posted. And then I'll also have an image of your work post, and it goes on my website.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Sounds good.
Okay. You be well. Keep working.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Okay.